The third case for oral argument this morning is in the matter of Edna Jane Howe. This is actually a consolidation of four separate appeals. Due to the four appeals being combined, we are allowing a little additional time for the oral argument. My understanding that Mr. Jeff Adel, who represents Lance Howe, will speak for 20 minutes. Is that correct, sir?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And then Ms. Candy Thompson will speak for 20 minutes.
Correct.
All right. And then Mr. Johnson, you will present the entire argument for the estate. Okay. That'll be 40 minutes, and then 5-minute rebuttal by Mr. Adel, and then a 5-minute rebuttal by Ms. Thompson, right?
That's correct.
Okay. With that, we will proceed. Mr. Adel, you may go ahead.
May it please the court. I am here today representing the interests of Lance Howe, the grandson of Edna Howe. Now, you've already read and are going to hear a lot about relationships between various people, between Randy Howe and Edna Howe and Michael Howe and Randy Howe, and that may all be relevant to the appeal of Randy Howe, but it has nothing to do with Lance Howe's appeal in this matter. The record is quite clear that Lance Howe had a very close relationship with his grandmother, Edna, and that he had a good relationship with his Uncle Mike and his Uncle Randy. That's not the issue. The issue in regard to Lance Howe is whether he qualifies as a beneficiary under SDCL 2155 and so is unable to make a claim to part of the proceeds of the wrongful death settlement in this matter. Now, in reading that statute, what it says is that a wrongful death action is for the benefit of the wife or husband and children, or if there be neither of them, then for the parents and next of kin. Now, the question, of course, is, does that reference to children mean that it's only surviving children who can be beneficiaries, or does it mean all children, so that whereas here you have a predeceased child, Lance Howe can be a beneficiary, the son of that predeceased child, by right of representation? Now, when you look at that statute, it's important to not only look at what it says, but what it doesn't say. And it does not say surviving children. Just says wife or husband and children. And then it says, or if there be neither of them, then the parents are next of kin. It would have been very easy, had our legislature intended to put the word surviving into the statute, to have put it there. There are a lot of states that do that. I counted 28 states where the wrongful death statute explicitly says surviving. Ours does not. I would suggest to you that the logical inference from that is that our state statute intentionally does not say surviving, because the intent was not to limit recovery, not to limit the class of beneficiaries to surviving children, but to let it be all children. And so then that when you have a predeceased child, the children of that predeceased child can be beneficiaries by right of representation. I would suggest that that becomes clear when you look at the history of our wrongful death statute. As I'm sure you're aware, all wrongful death law is statutory. There was no recovery for it under common law. Because of that, these statutes are remedial. They were put in place for the purpose of allowing recovery for wrongful death by certain relatives. And of course, which certain relatives is who we're talking about. The first wrongful death statute in South Dakota was passed in 1887, before we even became a state, when it was still Dakota Territory. And that statute said that the beneficiaries were the widow or heirs of the deceased. And of course, the question there was who was an heir, and that question was decided in the Lintz versus Holy Terror Mining Company case, which is cited in our brief. And what the court said was that heirs were heirs of the body or issue. And when you look at what those terms mean, that means lineal descendants, children, grandchildren, etc. Those were the beneficiaries who could recover under the wrongful death statute, whereas other relatives, parents, brothers and sisters, nieces and nephews, what are sometimes called collateral relatives, could not be beneficiaries. That was the line the court drew. Now, what that meant was that there was a loophole in the law, that if you had someone like Mr. Lintz had never been married and had never had any children. So he did not have any widow or, according to the court, any heir. And that meant if someone like him was wrongfully killed, there could be no recovery. That wasn't what the legislature intended, it wasn't what it wanted, and so in 1909 it changed the law to read as it reads today. The wife or husband and children, or if there be neither of them, then the parents and next of kin. Clearly, what the legislature was doing was taking care of that loophole that was opened up in Lintz. They were saying, even if there isn't a widow or an heir, we still want there to be recovery by somebody. And so they expanded the class of beneficiaries in that statute. Clearly that was the intent of that change. I would encourage the court also to take a look at how other states have decided this issue. Now, again, there are 28 states where the statute explicitly says surviving, and if it says that, that's what the court in those states is going to hold. But that leaves 22 other states where that word doesn't appear in the statute. And when you look at case law from those states, you can see a current trend in the law to allow recovery for grandchildren who are situated the way Lance Howe is. Now, none of those state statutes are worded exactly like ours is, because there aren't any state statutes that are worded exactly like ours is. But the common thread that you see running through these cases is that the statute does not explicitly say surviving, and the court allows beneficiaries to be lineal descendants of the deceased and allows a recovery for those lineal descendants if those lineal descendants can show a close relationship to the deceased, as Lance Howe did here. And I'd give you a few examples of those cases. One of them is Swiney v. Waters. That is found at 716 Southern 2nd 702. It's an Alabama case from 1998. In that case, the court said that grandchildren who were children of predeceased children of the deceased are beneficiaries entitled to share in wrongful death proceeds because they are lineal descendants of the deceased. There's a New York case, Gonzalez v. New York City Housing Authority. That's found at 572 Northeast 2nd 598. That's from 1991. Again, the court ruled that grandchildren situated the way Lance Howe is, the child of a predeceased child, can recover if that grandchild can show a close relationship to the deceased. Another case is Calhoun v. Frisco Railroad. That was a Sixth Circuit case that interpreted Tennessee law. That's found at 64 Federal Appendix 420. That's just from last year, 2003. The court again found that grandchildren situated the way Lance Howe is have a right to recover under the wrongful death statute. Again, the statutes in those states aren't worded exactly like ours because none of them are. But the common thread, again, is that the statutes do not say surviving, and the court didn't put that word in there. Instead, it said that people who are situated as Lance Howe, who are lineal descendants of the deceased, can be beneficiaries under the wrongful death statute. In fact, even in states where the statute does say surviving, the courts are starting to realize the injustice that this can create and are encouraging their legislatures to change that law. And a case that I would cite to you in that regard is from Louisiana. It's Mazzoni versus Avondale Industries. It's found at 839 Southern 2nd 771. This is again a Louisiana case from 2003. Their statute specifically said surviving, and so the court felt that it had to rule that way. But when you look at that case, you can see that the court realizes that it's doing an injustice by ruling that way. They felt they had no choice. But you can see that they feel this is wrong, that it's unfair, it's inequitable, and that the law should not be that way. Now, you do have a choice. You don't have the constraint that the Louisiana court had, because our statute does not say surviving. And I would give you some examples of how the restrictive reading that the trial court gave to that statute can work more injustice and much less justice than would an expansive reading. First, I would use basically the facts that we have here in front of us today with just minor changes. First, let's suppose that all of the bad behavior that's been alleged against Randy Howe is true. I'm not saying that it is. I'm not trying to prejudice his case. I'm just saying suppose that it is, just for the purposes of this discussion. Now suppose one other thing. Suppose that Michael Howe had passed away a few days before Edna Howe passed away. What the trial court would be saying under their ruling is that the only person who could be a beneficiary under the wrongful death statute is Randy Howe. Randy Howe, who had allegedly abandoned his mother for 7 years, who supposedly threw her all of her stuff on the lawn and said if it isn't picked up by 5 o'clock, it's going to the dump, he would be the only person who could be a beneficiary under the trial court's reading of this statute. Lance Howe, who had a very close relationship with his grandmother, could not be a beneficiary. Michael Howe's children, who from the record apparently also had a good relationship with their grandmother, could not be beneficiaries. The only one who could be a beneficiary is Randy Howe, and what the trial court ruled was because of Randy Howe's behavior, he wasn't entitled to get anything because it wasn't fair and equitable for him to get anything. So you would have a situation where there was no one who could recover under the wrongful death statutes. We'd be right back to where we were in the Lentz case over 100 years ago. That's clearly not what the legislature has intended. It's not equitable, it's not right, it's not just, and it does not have to be the law in South Dakota because our statute does not say surviving. I'd give you another example. We live in a time that right now where an increasing number of children are being raised by their grandparents. According to the 2000 census, there has been a 43% increase just in the state of South Dakota in children being raised by their grandparents. Now, under the trial court's restrictive reading of this statute, what you would be saying is that if those grandparents were somehow wrongfully killed, the only way...
Right, but this statute was passed in 1909. It sounds like you're making a pitch to a legislative committee meeting to say that now because we have more grandparents raising kids, we should modify the definition of children to include grandchildren. We're here basically not on a case of justice, but a case of statutory construction.
That's correct, and you have a choice as to how you're going to construe the statute. You can construe it restrictively so that lineal descendants cannot recover, or you can do as some of these other states have and construe it broadly so that grandchildren can recover. And what I'm suggesting to you is in making that choice that you should make the choice that will best serve the ends of justice and that will serve the remedial purposes of the wrongful death statute.
I have a question on interpretation of this statute also, and that if there are no children, then the parents and next of kin are in line. What do we define next of kin?
No, we don't, Your Honor.
So let's assume there were no children and there were no parents. Would the grandchildren be the next of kin?
If you chose the restrictive reading of the statute so that they cannot be lineal, so that you do not classify them under children, then yes, they would be next of kin. I would suggest to you that that's too restrictive a reading of the statute to use.
Well, are you saying that the term children in the statute actually includes grandchildren?
I'm saying that it includes lineal descendants, that's what the legislature had in mind in 1909, looking at the Lentz case that had been decided a few years earlier. I'm suggesting that if they had intended to limit recovery to surviving children, they would have put that word surviving into the statute. It certainly is not an uncommon word. It's something we use all the time in talking about death, who are the survivors. 28 other states found it necessary to put the word surviving in the statute. If that word children inherently meant surviving children, then those 28 other states would not have bothered to put that word in the statute.
As a matter of fact, there's a lot of public policy reasons for including children of a deceased parent or grandchildren who are the offspring of a child. For example, we have, nobody in South Dakota can make a will and disinherit children of a deceased child without intentionally doing so, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so if you can't do that, when you make a will and you're doing exactly what you want to do, there certainly is a reason for arguing that the word children includes the children of a deceased child. Because when you look at pecuniary interest, those grandchildren might have a far greater pecuniary interest in the estate of their grandmother than either one of the sons, who are basically adult and independent. And secondly, we have anti-lapse statutes, and all of this supports the proposition that word children should include children of a deceased child.
That's correct, Your Honor, and that's exactly what I was getting to in my discussion of the number of grandchildren who are being raised by their grandparents. What you would be saying under the trial court's restrictive reading is that the only way those grandchildren could receive anything from the wrongful death of their grandparents is not only that their parents had to be dead, but that every one of their aunts and uncles on that side of the family also had to be dead. If one of those aunts or uncles, who was a child of the grandparents, was still alive, that one aunt or uncle would be the only person under the trial court's reading who could be a beneficiary under the wrongful death statute. Those grandchildren could receive nothing, and it wouldn't matter if that adult child had any kind of relationship with the grandparents
whatsoever.
How
do you account for the word exclusive? Now, the statute says, shall be for the exclusive benefit of the wife or husband and children.
Well,
do we ignore that word, exclusive?
No, certainly not. But again, you have to look at the history of the statute. That word exclusive was in there prior to the change in 1909 when it said exclusive benefit of the widow or heirs. And the legislature had the court's reading of the Lentz case in front of it when it made that change in 1909. It assumed because of what Lentz had said that grandchildren would be included in children because the Lentz case had said you look to lineal descendants. So no, you don't eliminate that word at all. So again, I would tell you that our statute does not say surviving children, it just says children. And the majority of states have found it necessary to put that word surviving in there if that's what they meant. Our state did not. I would suggest that there's a reason that they did not.
Now, if Lance is included, he has two siblings, right?
Half siblings, yes.
Are they lineal descendants of,
yes,
of the decedent?
Yes, they would be. So, and they would also be beneficiaries under this reading of the statute. But now, one thing you have to remember is that in order to actually receive a part of the proceeds, there's a two-step process here. The first step is that you have to be a beneficiary of the estate. The second step is you have to show that it's fair and equitable that you actually receive something. The reason that Lance's two half-sisters, Tia and Kimberly, are not involved in this case is that they had no relationship with their grandmother, Edna. They could not show that it was fair and equitable for them
to receive. Well, shouldn't that be determined by a finding of the trial court?
Sir,
I mean, the whole case is screwed because the Michael, the personal representative of the state, excluded everybody and only brought a lawsuit for himself.
That's correct. And certainly on a remand, Kay and Kimberly ought to have the opportunity to come in and show that they had some relationship to Edna House so that they could deserve a recovery. I don't think they can show that, but certainly they should have the opportunity to. We're not trying to exclude them.
Right.
Other than based
that kind
on
of
facts.
That kind of finding isn't made in the absence of evidence when they're not even parties to the lawsuit.
That's correct. And again, they certainly should have the opportunity. And if they can show that they actually are entitled to something, that it's fair and equitable that they receive a portion of the proceeds, then they should receive it. We're certainly not trying to exclude them.
Mr. Adell, you say it would be logical that we determine that since the legislature did not say surviving children, they must have meant even deceased children. Wouldn't it be just as logical to assume that because the legislature didn't say grandchildren, that they must not have intended to include grandchildren in those exclusive primary beneficiaries?
Well, and again, that gets to the choice that this court has to make today. Because yes, it doesn't say lineal descendants, and it doesn't say grandchildren. It also doesn't say surviving children. What I would suggest to you is that there are a majority of states that do say surviving children, so that's a strong indication that there's an intent that when that word isn't in there, that it was left out deliberately. I would say to you also, when you look at the history of the statute, you see why it's not in there. I would say that when you look at the law of other states, you see the trend being to include these grandchildren. And I would also say to you that when you have a choice of how to interpret a statute, you should interpret that statute in a way that will do justice and not injustice. And expanding the class of beneficiaries will not work injustice because, again, it's a two-step process. You won't have, if you expand the definition of beneficiaries, people who have no right to any share of the proceeds coming in and getting those proceeds because they won't be able to show that it's fair and equitable that they receive something. You'll open up the class of beneficiaries, but you won't expand the people who can actually receive something to include people who don't deserve it. I would suggest to you that's exactly why the legislature set up this two-step process.
You have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. That the reason for this two-step process was to say, number one, we want everyone who might have an interest, who might be a beneficiary, to be able to come in and show that they have that right. But number two, we want the court to be set up as a gatekeeper to see who is actually entitled to a share of those proceeds, who it's fair and equitable to have received those proceeds, so that we don't have all and sundry coming in, people who had no relationship with the deceased, just coming in to try to get a quick payday. That's not what Lance Howe is doing, because the record is clear that he had a very good relationship with his grandmother Edna, a very close relationship. However, if there was a relative that was doing that, they would not get a share of the proceeds, because that's what the fair and equitable standard is in there to take care of. So again, I would say that when you look at the history of the statute, when you look at what the statutes say in other states, when you look at what the courts have ruled in other states, and when you look at justice, all of those factors mitigate in favor of reading this definition of children broadly to include lineal descendants. That is how you will do justice. I thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel. The court failed to notice, inform the audience that Justice Zinner has disqualified himself from this matter, and that the Honorable Stephen Jensen, a circuit judge from the First Judicial Circuit, has been appointed to sit in his place. Ms. Thompson, you have 20 minutes.
I should clarify at first that I do represent Randolph Howe, who would be the brother of Michael Howe, who's the personal representative in this action. We did not participate in the appeal filed by Lance Howe. So my argument that I have here that I will be presenting is with regards to Randolph Howe's appeal. And I would also like to point out that it's my understanding that the appellee appearing here today is representing Michael Howe in his individual capacity, as opposed to his capacity as personal representative for the estate. If I'm incorrect on that, I'm sure I will be corrected, but that's my understanding.
Is that what the file says?
Good question. I believe the... It says attorney for Michael Howe. It does not clarify. However, at the trial, attorney Pat Getzinger appeared on behalf of the estate, while Mr. Johnson appeared on behalf of Michael Howe in his individual capacity. Michael Howe had counsel both in his capacity as personal representative as well as in his individual capacity. The first issue I would like to discuss is the standard of review that is applicable. Obviously, I discussed this in my brief, but I feel it's necessary to mention it again in light of this court's decision in the estate of Watson, a 2003 case. 2003 South Dakota 142, I believe. In that case, this court used an abuse of discretion standard in reviewing the allocation or property division that was completed in that case. And I wanted to point out that I don't feel that the abuse of discretion will be the proper standard of review in this case due to the fact that we have legal errors and statutory interpretations, of course, that carry a de novo standard of review. I believe that errors will be found at that level before this court even gets to looking at the allocation that was completed by the trial court, and thus the abuse of discretion standard will not be applicable. The errors that I mentioned, the errors at law, the basic principle is whether in the 21-5-8 statute, which is the allocation statute, whether the pecuniary injury standard of 21-5-7 is applicable. And looking at the findings of fact and conclusions of law entered by the trial court, it's very clear that he relied very heavily, if not exclusively, on the pecuniary injury standard. During the allocation hearing, that was the standard that was applied, as opposed to the standard of 21-5-8, which is fair and equitable, giving reference to the age and condition of the parties. The appellee disagrees with our argument, suggesting that the appellant Randolph Howe's interpretation of the statutory scheme is illogical. However, I think by example and application to our current set of facts, I can show the court otherwise. The appellee believes that the allocation must be decided based upon pecuniary injury, because that is the standard of 21-5-7, which of course is the statute that gives you guidance as to how the jury should decide the amount of damages to be awarded. I'd like the court to consider a possibility of having a couple who was killed in a car accident, for example, and there's a wrongful death action, and it's determined that it is the fault of the manufacturer of the vehicle they were driving. They have two children, two daughters, a 17 and 25 year old daughters, who if they, let's just assume for purposes of this example, if we go under 21.5.7 in front of a jury, each daughter could prove, or together they could prove, pecuniary injury of $200,000. However, similar to the case we have here, there is a settlement that is reached as opposed to going to trial. And the settlement is reached rather quickly, and it is, for example, $1 million. And the reason why a settlement was reached that is not an actual reflection of pecuniary injury is because the car manufacturer wanted to settle the action quickly, didn't want publicity because it was an error in the manufacture of their vehicle. This type of thing happens. It's not uncommon. And I want to use that example to explain why the standard of determining the amount of damages in a wrongful death action in front of a jury is different than the standard that is applied when you're allocating between the statutory beneficiaries. Under the example that I have, we have more money over here in the pot than what we have actual pecuniary loss. So right there, it's not logical, and it's certainly understandable why the legislature would decide to adopt a standard for allocation that does not use pecuniary injury as the basis. And then we move on to 21.58. In my example, I had a 17 and a 25-year-old girl, and let's say in that type of scenario, you have one who has probably gone to college, their parents paid for that. You have one who maybe their parents even paid for the wedding. The point is, you could divide, the court would have discretion then to divide the wrongful death damages between these two beneficiaries, not necessarily equal, but fair and equitable, giving reference to the age and condition.
But didn't we in Watson just recently indicate that you could consider the pecuniary loss when determining what's fair and equitable?
If my interpretation of Watson is correct, I believe this court referred to a statutory scheme of the wrongful death statutes. And the way I read that case, this court would not find it error if pecuniary injury was considered. But I also don't think this court said that that is the absolute determinative standard. And in this case, I think it's very important to look at the specific conclusions of law entered by the trial court. In reading through those, all of the conclusions of law are based upon pecuniary injury. Specifically, they're based on Randolph Howe's failure to prove any pecuniary injury. They are not, I would like to note, and I was going to mention this later, but it goes with your question. It's important to note that there are very few affirmative conclusions that Michael Howe proved any pecuniary injury. And this is, I'll go back, but I'll go ahead and on this theory here to answer your question in more detail. Also, under Watson, a very important distinction to make is in that case, the trial court had two parents of an adult child. He let both one of them walk into the courtroom and basically said, there's no presumption of pecuniary loss for either one of you. You prove you had any reasonable expectation of future support from your adult son. Now, in that situation, the mother was probably unusually dependent on the adult son more than we even find. I think he'd even claimed her as on his taxes 1 year. So in that case, it worked out that you had one parent who proved pecuniary loss and the other one didn't, or excuse me, I shouldn't say pecuniary loss, actually future expectation of support is the standard that was applied by the court. And so trial court gave the mother the majority, all but a dollar, of that allocation. But both of those beneficiaries walked in there and started on equal ground. We didn't have that in this case. If you look at the conclusions of law, it was basically, okay, Randolph, you walk in here and prove why you get any of this money, because you're the bad son and Michael's the good son. And I mean, it was an incorrect presumption to begin with. It was an incorrect standard of law that was relied upon. And using the example that I was discussing and applying it to the current action, we had an 81-year-old woman, Ms. Howe, was 81 years old. She was in a nursing home, had been there since 97. She died in 99. Joyce Tipton, who was her former daughter-in-law, visited her 6 months before she passed. She testified that she found Edna in a fetal state, not able to recognize her, and very limited communication. My point is, we have a settlement here well in excess of either one of these beneficiaries' pecuniary loss that they could have proved at trial. In looking at the settlement, it's clear that the wrongful death defendants paid for confidentiality. We very well know there is a confidentiality agreement that went along with the wrongful death settlement. And it's clear that they paid for that. In fact, Mr. Johnson, in his argument during the July motions hearing dealing with the supersedious bond, discussed how important the confidentiality agreements were. Without them, the settlement would be lost. And that's how important these confidentiality agreements are. So in looking at that, clear example of why pecuniary injury should not be the determinative standard and how our interpretation...
Is there anything in the record that supports your spin on this? But did the court make findings or something at some place that the settlement was in excess of the pecuniary loss and the defendants were basically buying quiet?
No, Your Honor.
All right.
There was not. Also, I would point out, as is reflected in our brief, one of our issues is the fact that in the allocation petition, which is the pleading that led to the allocation trial, it was originally the personal representative, through his attorney that represented him as personal representative, Pat Getzinger, filed his petition requesting that 97% of the proceeds go to the wrongful death action and 3% to the survivor action. Mr. Johnson, as Mike Howe's attorney in his individual capacity, moved to amend that pleading the morning of trial. The parties were not prepared to discuss the survival action at that time, and there was objection made to the prejudice of that. However, the court proceeded. In his conclusion, he actually, in his findings and conclusions, he actually finds that that it was not contested, that 20% would be the allocation to the survival action. That was that finding was an error. The reason I'm going on about that is the condition of Ms. Howe was not litigated as much as you would usually see, because the allocation of the survival action was not at issue. But Ms. Tipton did testify, as well as Lance Howe testified, as to his visitation with Ms. Howe and the condition that he found her in. But you need to remember, at the time of the trial also, the counsel was advised, and I believe I was not trial counsel, but I believe it was understood that due to the confidentiality agreements, no numbers would specifically be mentioned at the trial, and they were not.
In the, I'm looking at the some findings at the trial court, or actually it's conclusions of law, and the trial court does reference that regardless of the recovery or the pecuniary recovery, that it would have been justified for the court in determining fairness and equity that he should not recover. So it would indicate to me that the trial court did determine fairness and equity, or did weigh this, and there's a lot of findings also about the relationship that Randy had with his mother. Why would not that be I guess when I'm reading that, it looks to me like the trial court did make this determination also with reliance upon fairness and equity.
I recognize that the court did make mention to the fairness and equity in passing almost, in my opinion. If you look at the second conclusion of law, it's 21-5-7 that he states as the standard. He actually cites to that statute in its entirety, and when you read through the rest of the conclusions of law, it's clear that pecuniary injury was the determinative standard that he relied upon. And although I recognize in Watson this court has suggested that some reference to pecuniary loss may be justified in deciding what's fair and equitable, I think the trial court went too far in this action in applying the standard incorrectly, and also in not applying it fairly to both individuals. When you look through the findings and conclusions, it's all what Randolph did not prove. At what point did Michael prove that He had pecuniary loss in the amount of this settlement. And even another consideration, why is Michael's confidentiality worth more than Randolph's confidentiality?
I assume we agree with the argument that we should look at more than just pecuniary loss, or the trial court should have. What factors would you suggest the trial court should have considered that it didn't with respect to Randolph in making a distribution to him?
Recognizing that there has to be some focus on the relationship, the record reflects that Randolph had not spoken with his mother for the last 7 years of her life, which I can't contest that. However, if you consider the amount of time that Edna lived in Pierre, during that time Randolph took care of his mother. Randolph's dad passed away, I believe he passed away in 81, and it was Andy, the other son, passed away in 86. Randolph did all the normal things that a son does for his mother when they live in the same town, mowed her lawn and took care of her. They went out for dinner together, you know, normal relationship. And she did not move to live by Michael until 1992, 7 years before her death. So during the majority of her life, she lived by Randolph. They had a very good relationship. If you take a look at this case, you'll find that Michael Howe is a very aggressive person by his own testimony, where Michael also admits that Randolph is a very shy, very passive individual. Michael and Randolph, to put it lightly, did not get along. And unfortunately, these brothers let that affect the relationship with the mother, depending on who she lived closer to. And which is an unfortunate thing. I'm not condoning the actions. However, when you take a look at the 21.58, we're talking about fair and equitable giving rise to the age and condition of the parties. And to me, that is not, if the legislature intended the primary determination to be that of pecuniary injury, that's not how the statute would read. If you look at other states, many states actually have pecuniary injury included in their allocation statute also. Our legislature does not do that. In my research and in my brief, I'm not convinced that pecuniary loss should be considered at all, but I'm bound and have to recognize this court's decision in Watson, which obviously it's a very new decision, so my ability to persuade you as to what it means is limited, because I'm sure you all know what you intended by it. But it does not appear to me to be the case that says we're going to consider pecuniary loss. And in a situation like this, I think it's a prime example as to why you cannot. When you have settlement proceeds well in an amount in excess of what could actually be proven, then which way is a better way? Here, really, Michael got everything by default, is the way I look at it. He didn't have to prove anything, whereas they held Randolph to a standard that was different than Michael. Now, it would have been interesting in the Watson case if the mother had not had any reasonable expectation of future support either. In that situation, what would the trial court have done? Can wrongful death proceeds escheat to the state because no one can prove any pecuniary loss? Or do we divide them based upon the age and condition of the parties and look at some other factors? A lot of times what you're going to find the factors that they look at is you could have a wife, obviously, who's an adult, and then there could be children who are either minors, and obviously a lot of times they're going to look at the age and condition and give more of the money to the minors. Or you also have a number of different family dynamics where the children may not be the children of the wife. And so there's a lot of different circumstances that can arise, even under the wrongful death statute as we look at it, with only two statutory beneficiaries. Recognizing there's some other arguments out there as to who also may be statutory beneficiaries.
So as far as the answer to the question of what factors to look at, you look at age, condition. We've said that you can look at pecuniary losses. Are there other factors that one could direct the court to look at, or does this really depend upon the facts of the individual case?
I think it would be basically a totality of the circumstances, looking at the certain facts and circumstances. In a type of case where you have, like we have here, where the settlement was in part at least based upon confidentiality, I think that that's going to be a consideration. Or if it's settled for some other reason, lawsuits are settled for other than actual damages quite often. You can also look, there could be a number of different factors that could come under fair and equitable. That's why it is fair and equitable. I think that allows you to look at the totality of the circumstances.
You have approximately 1 minute.
Thank you. Your Honor, I think the very quickly on our other appeal, the appeal dealing with the bond, I don't have much time, so our basic problem with that is that it is not logical to require Randolph Howe to post a bond when no one could ever take any action against that bond because he was never ordered to pay anything. And in an estate action such as this, the personal representative is in control of the money. Michael was the personal representative. It's a question of how is the estate money going to be distributed. Randolph would never have to personally pay any money to Michael. So this is not a money judgment as the statutory law allows supersedeas bonds.
Well, it wasn't a statutory judgment in Landstrom either, was it?
No. No. But in this situation, under the facts, and with it being a matter of an estate case where the money could sit there. In fact, I believe that Michael Howe had a fiduciary duty to leave the money. He's only holding it for the benefit of the statutory beneficiaries. And along those lines, kind of switches back to the other action, Michael Howe could not by law bring a wrongful death action for his own benefit. 2155 would dictate, and it was brought by the personal representative, and by law, it's for the benefit of all of the statutory beneficiaries.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Johnson, you have 40 minutes, sir.
May it please the court. In early April 1992, April 3rd or 4th, we think, my client, Michael Howe, and his son drove from Rapid City down to Pierce, South Dakota, where they retrieved his mother's belongings from the front yard and sidewalk of Randolph Howe, his brother. He did so under the threat that these were going to be hauled to the dump by 5 o'clock that day if he didn't get there. In the course of loading up his mother's personal effects, a whole pickup load, clothing, bank records, bedroom set, his brother, Randy, came out and said to him, "I never want to see you or that old woman again or speak to you ever again." And that's what started this. Real issues of this litigation. Now, Randy denied making these statements in his deposition, denied it completely. At trial, he fudged a little bit, but still denied making it. He also denied in his deposition that he'd gone to Gary Colwell's office shortly before this period of time, around March 31st or 1st, and had gone in there and had become so angry that he shook when he told Gary Colwell to keep his nose out of the family business because Gary had wrote a letter on behalf of Edna, who came to see him and wanted to get her own affairs in her own, she wanted to control her own affairs. And she asked to have her property returned to her. So he denied that also. The fact of the matter is the circumstantial evidence of this case shows that the threat that Randolph Howe made was serious and was in fact made. He kept his promise. Even though his mother went through the gamut of very poor health for the next 7 years, had pneumonia, serious bed sores that required surgery, broken hip, colon problems, another ileostomy. that she was only 180 miles away from him in Rapid City, South Dakota. He never once made an effort to contact her. He did not visit her. He never spoke to her or his brother again. He didn't send any get well cards. Didn't send any Christmas cards, birthday cards. Didn't make a phone call, even though at one time in the testimony he said that he didn't think he could find his mother out there. That was kind of part of his excuse. I don't think I could find her out there in Rapid City, he said. Or that he was scared to go out there and see her. He'd be in Rapid City periodically on other business or to see other relatives. He wouldn't stop and see her, even when he was in town. He didn't go to her funeral.
Let me ask you about that with respect to going to the funeral. Weren't there actually two services? Wasn't there a service in Rapid City that he didn't attend and a service in Pier that he did attend?
Well, there was a funeral in Rapid City. There was a burial, which I consider different. You don't go to the church and things in Pier. I think you go right out to the gravesite, burial, Your Honor. That's the way I understood it.
But didn't he attend the commencement service?
He did it. He did it, Pier.
All right.
Mr. Johnson, just to verify what was an earlier question, you only represent Michael and not the estate, right?
That's right. I represent Michael, and also in his individual capacity, and then he was the administrator, the special administrator, and the administrator of the estate. But I do want to touch on that. This is not, there's a clear dichotomy in the law between wrongful death actions and estate proceedings that somehow we kind of meld together in these proceedings. It gets kind of mixed up at different times, but I think, as you pointed out, in the Watson case, Your Honor, there's a wrongful death is its own specific statutory guidelines that are really not relevant to the estate proceedings in this case.
But doesn't a personal representative of the estate or the personal representative in the wrongful death action have a fiduciary duty to all of the heirs or all of the people who would possibly recover under that?
Well, I think that Judge Trimble addressed that, the personal representative under that statute. It says that the same should be for the exclusive benefit of the wife. The wife is ahead of the husband in that statute. The wife, the husband, or the children. And if neither, then for the parents or next of kin, which includes next of kin as the grandchildren, and the great-grandchildren, and the great-great-grandchildren. So they are covered under our statute, but they don't come into the picture until later. So the lawyer, Dan Palky, testified as to why he did that for Michael. There's only two children. Only one of them could show any pecuniary loss, loss of companionship, loss of advice, etc. Only one of them could show that. And as Judge Trimble said, it would have been frivolous for him to bring an action. I have to bring a frivolous action for Randy Howe, who had no relationship nor expectancy of a relationship.
Well, that's a finding or a spin, but that evades the question. Doesn't he have a fiduciary duty to whoever it is who's involved to be fair to everybody?
Well, I think he has to do it according to the statute, Your Honor. That's the way you read the statute. It says the action has to be brought for the exclusive benefit of these people. That's who he brought it for.
Right, but that's assuming your spin on whether or not children includes the decedents of a deceased child or grandchildren by a deceased child. I mean, he can't put his own spin on who's included in the statute and then violate fiduciary duties to him, can he?
Well, I don't believe he did. But
I know that.
Nobody can violate
their
fiduciary duty if they have that fiduciary duty.
That's right.
See, under your rationale, Your Honor, you'd have to search out grandchildren, and maybe great-grandchildren and things of that nature, and I don't think he has to do that. I think that's what Judge Trimble decided in this case.
Well, there was a finding by the trial court that there was a full and fair determination by the attorney for the plaintiffs in the tort case,
right,
that he had investigated that.
Right.
What specifically did he do? What was that full and fair investigation that
he
did?
I think the record's pretty clear. He testified quite a while, and he wrote a long letter to the Department of Revenue on that pretty much set forth his thoughts. He called and he interviewed people. He called Lance Howe. He interviewed Lance. He tried to get Randy there for a deposition, and he wouldn't come. He said he wouldn't even appear for a deposition on the case. And he did do, if you read that letter he wrote to the Department of Revenue, I think it sets forth his thought processes and his investigative processes in that regard, Your Honor. In regard to the state deals, I don't want to pass this by, is of course that Edna made a will after moving to Rapid City, by which she excluded both Lance Howe, and she gave $2,000 to Randy in her will. So if this thing falls into the estate, it comes out the same way as it does, as the court has ordered here, as far as the distribution of the wrongful death proceeds. Now, as this court recently held in Watson, said that the decision there by the father was a voluntary decision on his part to not to have any relationship with his son. Secondly, they said that he had the intellectual and the financial ability, if he wanted to maintain a relationship with his son, but that he didn't. And therefore, an award of $1 to him in that case was upheld. In this case, Randolph Howe didn't live in Florida. He lived 180 miles away. In the case of, in the Watson case, this court recognized the fact that the court relied significantly on the pecuniary loss of the, in looking at the award of the fair and equitable distribution of damages, including in that we can't forget the pecuniary loss in the state includes society and companionship, and that's a major consideration in coming into a fair and equitable determination. I think the record in this case, the bare record in this case, doesn't show very well the videotape that was taken of my client, Michael Howe, and his mother in Christmas 1998, 3 months before he passed away, a few days before she fell and broke her hip for the last time, showing them together at the nursing home, which they are at that time in the nursing home, showing them together where she's stating, I love you, and you can see that on the videotape, and that she says back to him, I love you more, and you can see the companionship and the close relationship as opposed to the other son who lives in Pierre and does not, and had no relationship, nor, I asked him, well, what did you expect in the future? None. He didn't expect to change his opinion about his having any dealings with his mother. The Judge Trimble said, I'll not reward Randolph Howe for his treatment of his mother during the last seven and maybe the most important years of her life. I'll not reward him with any distribution of funds to him. The fair and equitable decision that the court made, I think you've stated in the that this abuse of discretion would apply to that. Apply to that analogy. Now I want to address Lance Howe's arguments. In South Dakota, the wrongful death statutes, which are their own little province, unrelated to estates, and are something which was a remedy that was carved, did not exist in the prior common law. It's a remedy that's a statutory remedy that's been carved out. But our statute says that the wrongful death in their own little niche in South Dakota states that every action for wrongful death shall be for the exclusive benefit of the wife or husband and children. It doesn't say grandchildren. Or if there be neither of them, then of the parents and next of kin of the person whose death shall be so caused. Now, there's three significant parts of this. The first one being they use the word exclusive. Secondly, they define wife, husband, and children. Thirdly, they do include next of kin, which, matter of fact, I looked that up in Black's Law Dictionary this morning. Are your descendants, your blood descendants. So So grandchildren are in fact covered. Now,
you know, but they don't really define children. I mean, they don't define children as surviving children. They don't define children as lineal descendants of a decedent. They don't define children as including children of deceased children. They just use the word. They don't define it. That's what this whole lawsuit's about, isn't it?
Well, let me respond to that. First of all, the statutory rules of statutory construction say that you use the terms of the statute in the way that their ordinary meaning is. Judge.
Well, but I mean,
the ordinary meaning is that there's quite a bit of difference between children and grandchildren. I would suggest. Now, there's some great public policy arguments that maybe children of surviving children should be included, but they aren't there. The legislature has not put them there, and nobody's attempted to put them there. That's my response to that.
Well, I was quarreling mostly with your definition of definition. I mean, you're saying that you're saying they were defined, and I'm saying they're not defined. I mean, it doesn't say children shall be defined as such and such and such.
Yeah. Well, let me say this in regard to that. I know that they've stated that 28 states have used the term surviving children. I know I looked through their briefs again today, and I can't find any states that they referred to in their briefs on this 28 states business. But certainly they're not cited in their briefs. But here's part of the other problem, I think, on that has to be addressed, and Judge Trimble mentioned. Wrongful death damages refer to prospective damages in the future. If the child has been deceased for 15 years, it's hard for him to visualize how you would instruct, I guess, that there would be prospective damages on behalf of a deceased child that's been deceased for 15 years that their grandchildren could step in and take advantage of. I suggest to you, Judge, that plain and ordinary. There's something else I want to bring up on that. The relationship, you brought up a good point about estates, but we're not here talking about an estate. But the relationship between a parent and a child is quite a bit different in South Dakota law than a parent and a grandchild. For example, under 2577, a child has to support his parents for the necessaries of life. Grandchild doesn't. Great grandchildren don't. But that's something that enters into in a lot of wrongful death cases. The child has a legal obligation to do it. And I think also there's also some support obligations flowing the other way, but it does not flow to grandchildren. So I'm suggesting to you that the statute is in its plain and ordinary language works.
If we were to go the other way, whose relationship do you focus on, the deceased parent or on the grandchild? Because the statute says child. If the grandchild is appearing by right of descent, is it his, like Lance's relationship that controls, or is it Andy's?
Well, that that we never got to address that problem, but under the statute, I say that the only relationship will have to be with Andy. And the judge says, how can that be? And he's not here. And we're looking, wrongful death damages are based in the future, not in the past. But I guess they're arguing that that the child, we have to look at what the child did. In this case, contrary to the suggestion of there was a very close relationship. If you scour the records in this case, you'll see that Lance only paid one visit to his grandmother in 1997, 5 years after she left Pierre. He saw her at a wedding. He saw her at a graduation. But there's only one visit in 5 years here, so it's not like one of those deals that the judge, I know that you're concerned about, Judge, where there's a lot of people, great-grandparents that are raising kids. They should adopt those kids. And until the legislature changes it, that probably is the remedy that applies to the public policy argument that Justice Abrams has been raising here in this case. There's an argument, they haven't made an argument, they haven't pursued an argument about the promises. I thought I was going to get by with not having to argue this bond deal, but they raised it at the last, in the last 1 minute it's been raised here on appeal. I thought it was going to be waived. I just need to say, make a few comments about it then. This, when I studied this morning, I can't figure out the timing of this because I can't figure out all the notices of appeal and I didn't have all my records along to establish it. But I do know that the judgment was entered, first judgment entered on May 9th, and there was a final order July 7th. Nobody appealed the bond until August 21st. By Randy and then Lance on September 19th, nobody made an application for a stay. They just objected to the distribution. And I'm just going to suggest to you that I don't know, this troubles me that we have the bond issue being raised after the principal appeals here, and that this court's had made prior decisions as to what happens if there's not a bond filed or if there is a reversal of the decision. So in conclusion,
my understanding you to say they didn't make an objection at the trial court level?
Did they make an objection?
On this bond.
Yes, you see, Michael Howe petitioned out of abundance of being abundantly careful, even though the first judgment says the money should be forthwith paid to Michael. Out of an abundance of caution, he petitioned for another order to have that money distributed. And they appeared and objected. And the court said that if they're going to object, they're going to have to post a bond. So then we had another hearing on a bond. And that's as I perceive the record, that's how that came about. And I'm not sure I understand why the notice of appeal on the bond are like two and a half, three to 4 months after the other notice of appeal in this case, after the original judgment. Now, in Watson, this court held that the standard to be applied to the trial court would be that this clearly erroneous standard, particularly as regards to any issues of fact. They even go on to cite some language to the effect that to be an abuse of discretion, it needs to be against reason. I suggest to this court that the determination of Judge Trimble was within reason and was fair and equitable as he saw the facts, that the statute, that he did not decide that he should amend the statute himself, and I urge that this court should not amend the statute, to expand the language, to put the grandchildren, to jump them ahead of the, or if neither of them. I don't think this court should do this. I think that's a legislative prerogative, a legislative issue. Judge Trimble says, I'm not going to put the grandchildren up in there. And it was a little bit, in final conclusion, that as in Watson, the claims there of the father were such that he was unable to establish a meaningful relationship with his child while alive. And I think the court said he may not do so in her death. And in this case, that language and rationale is particularly applicable. And I urge this court to affirm Judge Trimble's decision.
Going back to the bond, just 1 minute, what was your understanding of why the trial court decided the bond amounts that it did? What was its basis for making that determination?
Well, that was the money that was to be paid.
That was the sole basis you understood?
That's my understanding of it. And I think he calculated interest because the Landstrom case required a determination of interest.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Mr. Adel, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I first want to make clear that in regard to the bond and any other issues that I don't get to, I'm not waiving any of those issues. We simply rely on what's in our briefs in regard to those.
Mr. Adel, if we buy into your argument that Lance has an interest, whose loss do we look at, his or his dad's?
You look at his loss, what's fair and equitable to be distributed to him. When you look at what other jurisdictions have determined that allow grandchildren to take, that's what they have found. That's also, I think, the clear intent. When you look at what the statute says, that what it's fair and equitable to distribute to the beneficiary, that again is how you avoid doing injustice by allowing persons who had no relationship with the deceased to get some money. It, assuming for the moment that Kay and Kimberly did not have any relationship with their grandmother, they then could not receive the proceeds of the wrongful death action simply because their father had that relationship. You would look at that person's relationship. You would look at Lance's relationship and also Kay and Kimberly's relationship. In regard to the comment about statutory construction, yes, you do give words their ordinary meaning. However, another tenet of statutory construction is that you don't put words into a statute that are not there. And the word surviving is not in our statute. The legislature chose not to put it there. In regard to Lance's visits to Edna, when you look at the trial transcript, you will see that Mr. Johnson's statement about Lance only making one visit to her while she was in Rapid City is simply not correct. And I would just encourage you to look at the record in regard to that.
Well, in that regard, if we did agree with you, we'd have to remand it, wouldn't
yes.
we?
Yes, you would. Whether there would have to be additional testimony or not, I don't know, because I think the parties, at least that were present, put forward all their evidence based on that. Now, clearly, if Kay and Kimberly should have the opportunity to come in, and if they want to, then obviously there would have to be a new trial. Whether there would have to be otherwise, I don't know that there would. Mr. Johnson made the statement that they looked at this and that Edna only had two children. That's the problem. Edna did not have two children. She had three children. She had Michael and Randolph and Andrew. And that's what we're deciding here today, is whether the fact is that Andrew was predeceased meant that he was no longer Edna's child. You have a choice to make. You can choose to read the word surviving into the statute when it isn't there, as the trial court did, or you can read this liberally to allow more people to become beneficiaries and do what wrongful death statutes were set up to do, allow recovery. I would suggest to you that when you look at what the statute says, when you look at other state statutes and what they say, when you look at the history of our statute, when you look at what other courts in other jurisdictions have said, and when you look at what will do more justice in more cases, all of those factors would lean toward giving this statute a broad construction. And unless the court has other questions, I really have nothing to say but to ask you to do justice in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Adel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Thompson, you have 5 minutes.
I have a question before you start on. You originally argued that we should not look at this case under an abuse of discretion standard. So what if I'm understanding that argument correctly, what you're saying is that because the trial court relied so heavily on the pecuniary loss, that is a mistake of law?
That's correct. I'm saying the court applied 2157, the standard of 2157, as opposed to 2158, which is a mistake of law. And I'm also saying the court's basic interpretation of the statutory scheme in the wrongful death actions in South Dakota was incorrect. In fact, I believe this appeal is basically an appeal of legal decisions, which is why I didn't go into great detail as to the who was the worst or better brother argument that was presented. However, I feel compelled to advise the court on those on that to respond to Mr. Johnson's arguments. And as noted in our brief, we do not concede, of course, that Randolph did not suffer any pecuniary injury. We believe that he did. This abandonment argument that has been presented by the appellee is not supported by the law. If it was, you'd basically do away with intestate succession in South Dakota if you hadn't spoken to the person in so long. I mean, the way that the laws are, not everything is based specifically on pecuniary injury. However, Randolph cared for his mother for after his father's death for 10 years of her life before she even moved to be by Michael. If you read through the transcript, which I'm sure you will, the amount of contact was daily. It was meals, it was mowing the lawn, it was putting up her storm windows. They participated in the Christmas tree program at State Capitol together. There was Dottie Howe, Randolph's wife, assisted with her checkbook. They helped her financially, all of these type of things. In fact, Randolph was stationed in Sioux Falls in the National Guard for a period of time, went home at least twice a month. He testified the first thing he did is he goes to his mom's house and checks on her.
Isn't that all past history, and isn't it subject to the question of, well, what have you done for me lately?
Well, that depends on whether you believe that you can have no loss of no pecuniary loss, as that term's defined in South Dakota, after you haven't had any contact with them for a period of time. It's whether you know, it's a quality versus quantity argument, I guess you could say, which is what the appellee is arguing. So as I state on that issue, even if pecuniary loss is considered, it is not a windfall for Michael. It's not. Randolph did not, as the appellee suggests, do a complete abandonment of his mother when it comes to feelings and that type of thing, which are all in the record. I can't testify to subjective things such as that. You have to look at Randolph's testimony in that regard. As far as the furniture incident, which you'll find becomes like the dominant issue in the trial transcript, I would urge you to look at Michael's son's testimony. If I recall correctly, he did not recall Michael and Randolph even exchanging words on that day. In fact, I don't think he thought Randolph even left the house. There was some question as to whether he even participated in loading up. So basically, if you apply the correct standard, which would have been fair and equitable, giving regards to the age and condition of the parties, we have adult sons. Both of them testified that they did not rely financially on their mother. We have a settlement a settlement that is not a true reflection of either son's pecuniary loss, whether you look at them separately or together. And under the fair and equitable standard, in our brief, as you see, our argument is an equal allocation would have been appropriate under the circumstances. Everyone else has advised you, there are many issues in our brief, and we do not waive any of them by not speaking to them, but just stress the most critical areas. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Thompson. Court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.